Okay, so now it's time to stretch yourselves a bit, get yourselves comfortable. Still quite a good turnout for a rainy day. A lot of people probably be on the retreat as well. So, why are you here tonight? What made you come here? When you get out of it? Nothing better to do? Sometimes it's good to ask ourselves, oh, what are we doing for? What's the reason we're doing things for? Making priorities in lives. What's the priority you have? Because it's important that, just, you know, having been in Singapore, I was quite flattered to see that how many people came to this retreat. It was 120 people on a meditation retreat, and they all basically gave up their major holiday of the year. I mean, if you think you've got tough luck here for getting, what do you get, 3 or 4 weeks a year holiday? Some of these guys in Singapore only get 2 weeks. And I said, I wouldn't do it. I couldn't do it, you know. It's one good reason to stay in the ropes. Just because I couldn't handle it, working 10 hours a day or whatever they work. There's a doctor there who's working 10 hours a day and then half a day on Saturday. And on Sundays he's on call, which means basically at least every other Sunday. So there's no holiday, no weekends. And then he might be lucky if he can, in a few years, 3 years, 4 years, before he can hope to ask for a holiday. So, and yet, a lot of those people are willing to give up their holiday for a meditation retreat. And they got a lot out of it because they, it was important. It was important to them because it was important. They put in the effort. And because they put in the effort, they got the results. And that's very simple and very important to understand. And because it's all cause and effect. I mean, there's no one in there. There's no one running the show. And if we can only, you know, find the causes, you know, establish the causes, then we get the results. But for that, we got to make priorities. So where is it that we make our priorities? Yeah, coming here on a Friday night, and listening to Dhamma, and hoping to be able to squeeze a little bit of happiness or at least a bit of entertainment out that you can take away and hopefully use in your lives in one form or another. So making priorities is very, very important, because if we don't, then we just keep being driven by habit, desire, aversion, and we just keep being pushed and pulled around without really prioritizing. And the thing, the job, the aim of the defilements of the mind, of greed, hatred, delusion, is basically the job, their job is to keep us making the wrong priorities, or keep us from making the right priorities, setting the right priorities. And so it takes effort, it takes a lot of courage sometimes to just go against the grain, do that which is difficult to do. And doing that which is difficult to do. Because we want happiness in life. But the problem is, most of the time, or often, we don't know where to look, where to find it. Everybody in this universe, every being that exists, you know, seeks happiness. We all seek happiness. And it's quite amazing what people are willing to go through or willing to endure for that which they perceive as happiness. And where does that happiness come from? What is it? Basically, we can put it down to pleasant feeling. We're after feeling. We want the the stimulation, that which exhilarates, gives us happiness, gives us some stimulation, pleasant stimulation. But we have to realize that what we're looking for in terms of, you know, pleasant stimulation is very conditioned, isn't it? It's so dependent, it's so fragile, and it depends on so many causes. And most of them we can't control. And so we spend our time trying to squeeze the happiness out of life. But if we don't understand where it's coming from, what the actual process is that leads up to even that very feeling that we are seeking, that pleasant happiness, happy feeling, whether it be a pleasant feeling through contact through the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, or the body, or whether it's pleasant thoughts, if we like thinking, contemplating, philosophizing, then if we understand the process, how pleasant feeling arises, then we have more of a means to actually find out where to establish those causes or how to establish those causes. And we can actually take a little bit more charge of our own lives. And when we look at the Buddha's teaching, how he described the arising of feeling, what it depends on, and the various factors that come together, then it's actually quite surprising that because it's such a short-lived thing, isn't it? I mean, pleasant feeling is like a blob. The Buddha actually gave a good simile. He described the various aggregates of that make up what we call existence, what we call me and mine. In those various aggregates, the body, the feeling, the perceptions, the thoughts that we have, and consciousness itself. He described feeling as a water drop that drops on a puddle in a rain, and just you get a little bubble that arises when the water hits the puddle, right? You get a little bubble, and if you ever see in the rain, now it's raining, you watch how the rain drops fall into a puddle, then you see these little bubbles bubbling up and then arising and passing away very, very quickly. And that's a very brilliant simile for that feeling that drives us, that keeps pulling and pushing us, the desire for pleasant feeling. And that feeling in and of itself, if you look at it, it's very short-lived. It's a very short blip, 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 blip. And before we know it, it's gone. And we have to look for another one. Yeah? And it's conditioned, it's dependently arisen. And why do some people feel differently? Why do some people perceive the same degree of sense contact in a different way? Simply because they've got very different conditioning. The same sense contact through the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, or the body can be completely different for different people. What may be pleasant for some may be unpleasant for others. And it's because of the way it actually works. And perhaps I say a little bit, and I won't go too much into depth with it, because it might become a little bit too technical, I'm afraid, but it's good to understand and how it actually works, because you've got the eye, say for instance, and you got forms that come into range of contact, right? You got the eye, and you got what we call sights. And for that, you need the mind attending to that eye or that sight. If the mind is completely absorbed in doing something else, then you may have an eye or two eyes, hopefully, and there may be forms that are within the range of, you know, your eyes, but because you're paying attention to something else, you might actually not see something, or you may not hear it, or smell, or taste, or touch. So there has to be the mind directing attention towards those things out there in the world, whether it's sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch. And if that interest, interest is not there, if the mind is not paying attention to those objects, then the sense bases, you know, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body, they won't actually make contact. Yeah? And the three coming together, the mind being interested enough in something, the form and the eye, the three, the coming together of mind of eye consciousness in that context, or ear consciousness, nose consciousness, the coming together is what we call contact. And that's where it actually becomes very interesting, because we think that the eye is being contacted, don't we? We think that the ear is being contacted, or the nose, or the tongue, or the body. Yeah? But if that was the case, then it would be the same for everybody, wouldn't it? I mean, the same contact would produce the same feeling for everybody. But that is obviously not the case. Certainly those who are a bit perceptive will know that it's very different for different people. And so what is actually being contacted there is not the eye, but it is the accumulated, the accumulated body, a body in a, not in a physical sense, but accumulated body of desire and aversion that we have created for and around certain sense contacts. Yeah? Say if we have, you know, desired something for a long time and it has given us pleasure for a long time, then when we have that particular sense contact, then it will bring up that same feeling again. Yeah? Whereas for other people, they have conditioned themselves to like or dislike other things. And so for them, what is being contacted, namely the mental component, and I heard a very nice description once. He said that the desire and aversion that accumulated, you know, as it were, body of desire and aversion. I don't know really how to put it or bring it across, but you might get what I'm trying to say. That is actually like the oil that lives in the wick of an oil lamp. And I love that simile, because if you imagine like the body being a physical thing, isn't it? It's the earth element, the air, fire, water element. But what is actually happening is that these things are steeped, they're drenched in this mental component. So our desire to see certain things and our desire to not see other things, our desire to hear certain things and not hear other things, to smell, taste, touch, think, some things and not others, that lives, yeah, in our sense basis, as it were, like the oil or the oil in the wick of an oil lamp. So there is that which is leaking out or leaping out through the eye to want to experience certain sights. There is that which is listening through the ears to hear certain pleasant sounds. There is that which is, you know, coming out through the nose, trying to pull in pleasant smells and avoid unpleasant ones. Yeah, there is that which is living in the tongue, which wants to taste. Yeah, there's the desire to have touch, to have pleasant contact, and to have a comfortable body, not too hot, not too cold. And so it is actually the mental component, yeah, that is seeking contact there. And so that is what is being really contacted. It is that much more than the actual sense basis. And if we understand that, then the contact, with contact as condition, there's feeling. Because as soon as those senses, because they're sensitive, that's what they call senses, because they're sensitive, and because as soon as these senses are making contact, you know, with the world around us, then there's feeling. That is nature. That is the nature of things. And that is to be either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And we just can't get out of it. Having a body means to have senses. And having senses means to be sensitive. And being sensitive means that we're going to feel. Yeah? And feeling means to have sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain, and sometimes neutral. Yeah? That which is neutral is that which we don't really perceive. It doesn't really turn us on, nor does it turn us off. And that's why it's called neutral feeling. Yeah. It's the sort of touch consciousness that you're having right now. We're sitting on the floor. You're not paying attention to it unless I tell you to, or you notice some itch or whatever it is. Yeah. But the general touch consciousness is not being perceived because you're not paying attention. But when you do, it's quite neutral. Yeah. So you have pleasure and pain, and that which is in between. And that is what drives us, isn't it? We want the pleasure, we don't want the pain. But we don't actually understand the process that brings pleasant feeling about. And if we do, which I'm hopefully trying to get across, then we will actually understand that we usually make the object of the senses responsible for our feeling. If somebody says something and it is unpleasant, then it is his or her fault, because they said something that made us feel an unpleasant feeling. If somebody says something nice, then it's their fault that we have a pleasant feeling. If there is a beautiful sight, pretty girls walking by, or whatever, sunsets or whatever have you, then it's pleasant, it's stimulating. And we make the object of the senses responsible, or we hold them responsible for our feeling, when in fact, it's not a case. They aren't responsible. We are responsible, or our, as I said, accumulated, conditioned body of like and dislike that we have conditioned ourselves with, which is the mental component or the mental aspect of our being, that is responsible. Yeah? And so if we understand that, then we can actually pay a lot more attention to our internal world and that which actually, you know, is going on inside, rather than blaming the world around us for our suffering or our happiness. Yeah? And if we understand that, then life becomes actually quite radically different, because it's just nature that the body will have contact, but it is up to us how we perceive that contact. And so what can we do about it? Is there anything we can do about it? Or do we just have to allow things to flow? Do we just go with the flow? And that's where the Buddha's teaching comes in when he talks about the guarding of the senses. He talks about the guarding of the senses. And that is a very, very skillful way of putting it. Sometimes they translate as sense restraint, which is sort of accurate, but it really brings, it really comes across as, restraining is always, people don't like it. I mean, you're supposed to restrain something. It just sounds terrible, doesn't it? I mean, you don't want to, cramp your style or whatever it is. You just, restraint just doesn't ring right with most people. And, but I like the idea of guarding the senses, because if we know that if we allow those senses to roam in their respective fields, unchecked, uncontrolled, unguarded, that will actually bring us suffering, because it causes trouble for us, then we have an incentive. And in the context of a particular meditation, we find that, because what we have to develop to be able to make the mind peaceful is this quality of mindfulness, isn't it? To be ability to sustain our awareness on one thing for a long, 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 long time without the mind spacing out, running all over the place, thinking here, thinking there, planning, remembering. Yeah? In order to be able to do that, in order to allow the mind to settle down to its natural state and experience some peace and calm in the present moment without being pulled and pushed and dragged and drawn all over the place like a slave, we have to have the mindfulness which is actually able to sustain itself on a particular object. Yeah? And that we can only achieve if we have some guard, if we hold some guard over where we allow the senses to roam. Because if we allow the senses to just run after everything that comes into contact, and just as soon as it comes into contact, we have to, the craving arises and you have to have that. And I don't want that, and I don't want this. And so we're constantly being pulled and pushed around, like a slave. If that is the case, you know, through most of the day. Then whenever we want to do meditation, whenever we want to focus the mind, you know, hold the mind on a particular object in order to allow it to settle down, we can't do that because the mind is just, you know, following its monkey habits, you know, of running all over the place, never being able to sit still, never able to be content with one thing. And so it's important what we do throughout the day. It's important what we do with our senses. It's important whether we just allow mindfulness to completely space out, you know, to completely run amok among the senses, allowing the mind to leak out through those five doors, these five sense doors. And if we do that, then we pay the price of not really being able to find any peace and calm, because the mind would be conditioned to always seek for some stimulation and avoid others. Yeah? However, if we cultivate just out of faith in the beginning that guarding of the senses, where we certainly don't go roaming or allowing the senses to roam in areas where we know we're going to be in trouble. Yeah? If you surf the net, you know, how easy is it to get into some porn sites? I mean, it's about 40% of internet traffic is porn. So if you don't want that, then you got to set up your mind to not do it. Yeah? Or if you go into, you know, certain pubs or clubs or places like that, then you know it's gonna have a particular effect. Yeah? And so. That's at least one way where we can check. So we don't frequent certain places. But even in the ordinary, you know, life, the contact that we have to make, you know, at work with people, we're not going to be able to have only pleasant sounds. You know, people are not always going to say pleasing things and nice things to you. Yeah? But what we can do is we can set up that mindfulness or that intention, you know, to see that as sound making contact with the ears, because that's all it is in reality. It's just that we create, you know, what we want on top of it, and thereby create our own happiness and suffering. Really, it's just sound coming into contact with the ear, full stop. It's just sight, it's just smell, that's all it is. Sometimes it's rotten, sometimes it's delicious. The truth is, that's all it is. You know, the mind has got no business in there. But we make that business. And because we make that business, you know, we condition ourselves to like certain things and don't like other things. And if we buy into that overly much, or certainly as a layperson one appreciates, it's very difficult to have that guard over the senses because there's so much stimulation out there. I mean, that's what this world is all about, isn't it? I mean, it's all about stimulation. It's about stimulating the senses to create some new desire so you can keep that economy going, otherwise it collapses, isn't it? And so there's people out there who create, you know, who fry your brain to keep the system going. Yeah? And if you buy into that trip, then you're going to pay a price for that. And that's something we have to realize. We have to know that. We have to see that, observe that, and then see, well, isn't it more worthwhile to actually train the mind? Because the senses are going to pack up on us anyway. I mean, when we die, I mean, dead people don't see nothing. They don't hear anything, smell, taste, or touch anything. Yeah? But the mind doesn't die. So the mind is that which we should train now. And the way to do that is to, you know, first of all, out of faith, and to have a little bit more guard over those senses and not allow them to stray so unchecked in their respective fields of contact. And then set up that mindfulness, bring that mindfulness into the present moment, yeah, so that whatever we do, you know, we have that, we remind ourselves to bring that mindfulness into the present moment, so at least we know what we're doing. Yeah? The people who don't know what they're doing, who haven't got any kind of mindfulness hardly at all, they will find it very difficult, you know, because they actually become literally, I mean, the complete slaves of those senses. Yeah? But those of us who have been practicing for a while, yeah, we know that there is a choice. Yeah? We have a choice sometimes. Even though, yes, people will say, but ultimately it's not self. So do we really have a choice? And of course, if you take that stand, then you might as well throw in the towel and, you know, you've had it, you know. But, I mean, conventionally speaking, there is a choice. Yeah, and you have to make that choice. Yeah. And even though you can say that, yes, okay, when I make a choice, because it's all conditioned, you know, I've been conditioning myself to make that choice. So really, I didn't have a choice. But that's just philosophizing. That's just you know, not really coming to terms with the fact that we are still living in conventional reality. We're not on the level of ultimate reality. Yeah? And so we can't really approach the practice from such a standard, with such a standard. So we have to admit that we are living in a realm of conventions. And so conventionally speaking, you know, we have a choice. You know, we have a choice whether we commit adultery. There's a moment there where there is a choice. And you can either resist it or you can give into it. Yeah, there's a choice whether you have that drink or you don't. And you can either make that choice to the advantage of your keeping of the precepts or not. There's a choice to make a lie, to speak a lie, and to not lie. It's funny, I was in Singapore, and it's like, the scene there is quite bizarre. I mean, there's so much cash in Singapore. I mean, there are people there which are really, really, really wealthy. When you speak with them, when you talk to them, you can pick it up. I mean, they're just getting this high out of making another deal, you know, which brings them another couple of million or three or five or 50 or whatever it is. I mean, you're talking really rich people, you know, and it is quite interesting to see how they aren't really able. It seems they haven't got a choice, you know, because they love that high so much, yeah, that they don't want that choice. But there is a choice. Yeah. So there's one person, he was arguing, well, but you know, in business you gotta lie. You have to lie in business. I mean, you can't tell the truth sometimes. You know, it's just impossible. I mean, if you want to get advantage over someone in a deal, you gotta lie. And that was just for him. That was just his view. I mean, that was just impossible to crack that view. And he said, with drinking, well, wine, that's just medicine, isn't it? I mean, that's not really alcohol, isn't it? I mean, you have to have a glass of wine with your dinner. I mean, it's just, you know, come on. And it was just fascinating to see, you know, because they're so conditioned, you know, into thinking that you just can't live in that world and, you know, have that integrity. That on the other level he was seeking, because he was obviously interested in monks, that's why he was inviting me. That's why I invited all his business friends, yeah, to this dinner. And because he loved listening to Dhamma, it stimulates him, it interests him, yeah, and he wanted his friends to come around and listen to Dhamma. Yeah, and some of which asked really excellent questions, and so we had a great old time. There was a couple of times when he invited me, and so it was really funny. And you could see there was this being torn between wanting to do good and wanting to move towards the Dhamma, but at the same time not really having a means to abolish or abandon the habits which deep down he knew were actually creating suffering for himself, but he just couldn't see a way out. Yeah? And so it was fascinating. And so that's, we're all the creatures of our own conditionings, we're all the creatures of our own habits, and so we have to really come to terms with, you know, what it actually does for us. Yeah. And you know, that's always the thing in Buddhism, isn't it? I mean, we have to use our wisdom. We can't just blindly you know, adhere to, you know, certain rules or rituals or you know, habits. And we have to keep investigating, we have to keep looking and looking at how cause and effect works. You know, if I do this, that happens. If I don't do it, this happens. Because that is what ultimately, you know, really makes us want to do the things that we clearly see are going to make changes in our lives for the better, which actually increase or enhance our quality of life. And so that wisdom is so important. But the wisdom can only really function if there is some sense of calm. Yeah? And in a person, in most people who live such busy lives, and to come to that sense of calm and peace and stillness, you know, where the mind can actually look and reflect back and see what's actually going on there, is very, very difficult. Yeah. And so when I said in the beginning, prioritizing, making priorities, we have to make the priority on a rational level, first of all. Yeah. We have to, on a rational level, say, well, I'm going to do this. We have to make decisions on a rational level as best we can at a time when we have, you know, where we have a choice, you know, or where it seems that we have a choice. Yeah. And so what we do is we set up a standard for ourselves. And if we have a standard, then we have what I call like a mirror against which you can hold, you know, your experience. You've got a standard, yeah. And because if people don't have a standard, then they've got nothing to fall back on, yeah. And they haven't got that what I call some of the safety net, yeah. Say our precepts, for instance, is our safety net. And I think I've said it here many times, that I see my precepts as a monk as my life insurance, literally. Yeah. Wherever I go, I'm being looked after incredibly well. Yeah. And it's like you can really stay in the present moment because you just don't have to plan anything. You know, you don't have to take a towel to Singapore because you know people are going to provide you with one. I didn't even have to take a toothbrush or a toothpaste or a razor or soap, because the first day I got there, somebody offered me what he called requisites, this neat little parcel. And there was a toothbrush in there, yeah? There was toothpaste in there, there was a bar of soap in there, there was a towel in there, there was a razor in there, yeah? And it was just amazing, you know? And so it's like when you do good. Or on that India trip I went to, you know, people afterwards, you know, some people like scolded me for doing the things I'd done on that India trip because it was irresponsible and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, was it? Or wasn't it? Because as far as I was concerned, you know, we were there with the best of intentions to go on a pilgrimage, and we wanted to do something good. Yeah, and we all were at our best. And, you know, if you do that, you just don't get mugged. Yeah, things don't go wrong. Yeah? And they didn't. They never did. Yeah? And so when you have a standard that you keep to, then you can take it. That will actually carry you through. Yeah, it carries you through life because it's the goodness that does it. It's the standard that we have, that we hold on to, which provides that safety net. And because if we don't have that safety net of the precepts, right, then it's like an acrobat that is somehow doing his stunts up there on this bamboo pole or on whatever else they do up there in the old circuses. I don't know if they have them these days anymore, but, you know, and if they don't have a net, you know, if they fall, that's just it. You know, they either just crash to death or you know, crippled or whatever. But if they have that net, then even if they fall, they still have that safety net to catch them. And the precepts are our safety net. We can never fall below a certain level. And so we have to create the standards in our life which, you know, based on faith, based on experience, preferably, you know, a bit of both, and the wisdom that we've cultivated over our time, use that to, first of all, on a rational level, set up, you know, the standard that we want to keep, yeah? And then stick to it, and then keep observing as we go along, you know, how we can actually improve it, and how it actually works for us, you know, how actually keeping the precepts is something that actually enhances or increases our life quality, betters our life quality. Yeah. Because all of a sudden you find if you don't lie, for instance, in this case, you find sooner or later you will become a lot more trustworthy and people give you actually better deals. Yeah? But in the beginning it seems, well, if I don't lie, then I don't get this deal. Yeah? And so there's always the thing that we have to draw a line, as it were, and then recognize the fact that we are still the owners of our own karma, in the sense that we will still receive the fruits of our old actions. We can't get out of that because we've created karma in the past. Yeah? And so whatever we experience now is all old stuff. Yeah? Whatever we experience now has already been created by us in the past. Yeah? We've created it through body, speech and mind in the past. And so the direct experience of now, a lot of that, is already, conditioned, created by us in the past. Yeah? And so when we stop lying, for many people, the argument is, well, people still lie to me, even though I don't lie. But people still keep lying to me. Well, that's old stuff, because you've done it before. You've and so you still receive the fruits of your old actions. But little by little, that's why, you've got to draw a line and say, well, look, now, because of my faith in the teaching, because of, the good talks I had with people who have practiced in this way, it is actually worthwhile. Now I draw this line, and I set myself a higher standard, to have that mirror against which I can reflect my life or my experience, and then be quite willing to still receive the fruits of my past actions, because that's what it is, isn't it? In meditation, that's why I said in the beginning, when we said meditation, we have to accept the present moment. If we don't accept it, there's no way that the mind can settle down. Yeah? So whether it's hot, whether it's cold, whether you're tired, whether you're itchy, whether you've got this, that or the other, the moment we can actually accept it, it becomes peaceful because of that acceptance. Yeah? Whether it's a disease, as long as you still fight it, it's going to torture you. As soon as you start accept it, the mind has a chance to become peaceful. Because it allows life to be what it is. And it doesn't frantically try to make life something that it can never be. We're never going to be living happily ever after. Yeah? I love that old Morrison quote. No one's going to get out here alive. And we just have to realize that. And we've got to start taking responsibility for our lives. We can't just blame the government and the weather and our friends and all this. We can't blame the world for our own suffering or for our own stupidity. We have to take charge. And that's why Buddhism never was a popular religion. Yeah? Because it's much easier to surrender to God and let Him take charge. Yeah? When I go to Germany, when I go back, that's the hardest one, the toughest one that my mates they can't get their head around, karma. They just don't want to accept it. Because if they accepted it, they haven't got no one to blame anymore. What a boring life. You can't blame your suffering on others anymore. But it's great fun if you can actually accept it, if you can just allow, life to be what it is. Yeah? And just allow those, and don't go seeking overly much happiness, because that's where I started the talk with, in areas where ultimately you're not going to get it. Yeah? The senses, it's going to pack up on us. And so, for lay people, there's always the argument, we're living out there and, we got to have our little happiness and we still have family and we need our sex and our food and all this kind of stuff. And it's fine. But at least know that the happiness that is really supreme, that is really a superior, is the happiness of peace, the happiness of wisdom, of understanding, the happiness that is in the heart, inside. In a mind that is content, no matter what the external conditions are. I mean, I didn't always sit in air condition when I was in Singapore. It was pretty hot and humid. I mean, never guessed we'd go 22 degrees there anyway, or 23, even in winter, you know. So it's pretty, you know, physically it's quite unpleasant in the sense that it's always humid. You're always sweating, you know, constantly. And I said to some people before I walked in here, I was desperate because when I came back just this afternoon, about, I got here about 6, I had to wash my robes because I hadn't washed my robes for 2 weeks. Because I washed them in this jackfruit dye. That's why I'm wearing my outer robe tonight. This is double layer one. But because I had to wash all my other robes because I hadn't had a chance to wash them in that jackfruit dye. And so that's the negative, the downside. That's the price you pay for being old fashioned like myself, enjoying the old natural jackfruit dye stuff, you know. But the nice thing about it is that it didn't actually really stink. If an ordinary robe washed in detergent, you know, after 2 weeks in Singapore, you wouldn't have had people come anywhere near you, you know. But with the jackfruit dye, it's very pleasant and very it actually endures a lot longer. Yeah. But this afternoon I had to desperately go and wash very quickly because I'm going off for a change to actually sit a meditation retreat in Melbourne. I can't remember why I actually said that now. I'm trying to make some point or other, but I forget. Washing my dirty laundry, or I don't know why. Never mind. Finding that incentive to, you know, do what we need to do. Yeah. Finding that incentive to go against sometimes the grain, and not to always give in, and keep investigating, keep looking, keep checking, you know, what it actually does. Because when as meditators, you know, we have to put in the time. I mean, there's so many people that I know, and they come to these retreats and they become like retreat junkies, as it were, and then after the retreat they let it all go again, and then the next retreat they sort of, you know, painstakingly sort of gather it all in again, and then they get a little bit of peace at the end of the retreat, and oh, that's wonderful, I got a nimitta at last, and the retreat finishes, and then boom, 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 gone. You know, I mean, some people blow it within an hour after the retreat. I mean, just by talking to each other after the noble silence. And, you know, it's just so difficult, isn't it, to have that discipline, you know, to have the discipline to just maintain a routine and just to set that routine up for ourselves. Yeah. And, you know, it's that catch-22 situation. If you don't know the peace of meditation, why bother? But if you never bother, you're never going to get the peace. So, you know, where are we going to start? Yeah. So, for myself, I always love it when I get more consistency, more continuity of mindfulness. And I really get it mostly in the rains retreat, because even for the monks, you know, even though we're supposed to have all this time, yeah. But still, it's amazing just how much worldly stuff still goes on in a monastery, even, you know, or how much people can even distract themselves in the monastery, you know, with this little project and that little project, and you do a little translating here and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and then the 24 hours go by pretty quickly, and you go to bed at night and, well, how many hours have I actually meditated today? Yeah, and sometimes it surprises you. It's not. I mean, I always say, as a monk, you should at least meditate 8 hours a day, or 10 hours, actually. I mean, most people work 10 hours a day for their living. So meditation is your livelihood as a monk, so you should get at least 8 or 10 hours of meditation a day. Yeah. And I feel guilty if I don't. I feel I didn't do my job, you know. And sometimes I use that as an incentive to just, you know, keep myself, you know, doing it. Yeah, and then when I keep myself doing it, because I'm actually doing it, something is happening. Because it's the nature of things. Because when you do things, things start happening. Like Ajahn Chah, he used to say, what's the point of this walking meditation? He's walking up and down, you know, like a stupid tiger in a cage. What are you going to get out of this, you know? And he never, you know, thought that there would be anything, any benefit in it. But he said, out of faith, he just kept doing it, you know, day in, day out, doing his walking meditation, until finally things started to happen. Yeah? And so that is it, you know. We have to be able to have that perseverance, the perseverance and the patience and the endurance. And, you know, talking about endurance, I mean, most people haven't got an ounce of it. I mean, it's just everything, like I said, I think I must have said it before, you know, everything is instant. You got to have your instant gratification and your instant this and instant that, you know, to the point on this retreat. They were even serving instant tea. I mean, how bad can it get, you know? I mean, you can't even make a decent cup of tea anymore, you know? Because you haven't got the time, you know, because life is just too busy. So making priorities, you know, is the thing to do. And then just setting up your routine and sticking to it. Because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, most of our lives is dictated by our job, you know, and we can't get out of it. Yeah? And there, we don't dare to even speak up, because we know if we speak up, we're out the door, because there's about 150 people waiting outside to get in. Yeah? For most people, it's like that. You can't say beep in your job, because you know you're going to lose it. And the paranoia of people losing their job, you know, turns them into people that they can do anything with. You know, and people are willing to work under incredible conditions sometimes, because they know if they rebel, if they say anything, then they're gone, they're out, finished. Yeah. So if we contemplate things like that, you know, how our life is actually effectively being dictated by so many other things, you know, why can't we then dictate our lives in a skillful way? Why can't we set up a routine that is actually going to be skillful for us? And so, well, it doesn't matter if I'm a bit tired today, I'm going to get up the extra hour, extra half hour, and do my meditation in the morning. Yeah? And I do my little meditation before I go to bed, because I know I sleep a lot more effectively if I actually allow the mind to settle down and calm down, come to a state of peace before I go to bed. I don't dream so heavily, and I feel more refreshed. Yeah? So, going back to this feeling, which is that is how I started a little bit talking about the talk. Feeling is obviously also in the mind, yeah? And the mental feeling as the Buddha said, has two kinds. It is the mental feeling that is, still connected with the world, and is the mental feeling that is connected with the Dhamma, connected with meditation. Yeah. And so when we look for happiness in the mind, yeah, it's the happiness that comes from two things. Either it is the calm and the peace, which is momentary. It's the momentary happiness that comes when the mind is able to actually become peaceful and settle down and enjoy moments of silence. Even if it's sometimes only for a few minutes, being able to see that the mind can actually not think for a few minutes is amazingly beautiful for people when they experience it for the first time. Because many people in the world think that you can't stop thinking. That people who actually don't believe that the mind can just be and know without a thought going on. Yeah, and so that kind of happiness is the one that we should aspire to, yeah, and create the causes for. Because the causes are mindfulness, the ability to sustain, like I said, and the mindfulness, again, is conditioned by the way we allow the mind to roam in the realm of the senses, yeah, throughout the day. Yeah. So to contemplate that, and then the other kind of happiness in the mind is the happiness of actually wisdom, which is the happiness of insight, of seeing the truth, of actually seeing that process work, because that is where actual changes will take place. You know, the happiness of calm or peace, the Buddha compared to a rock that you put on the grass. Once you put the grass can't grow. But as soon as you take the rock away, with a little bit of moisture, the grass will keep growing again. And so meditation on the level of just samadhi, Yeah, it's just calming for a brief period of time. Yeah. But the little insights that come along the way, when you actually see how that process works, that is where the lasting happiness comes from. It's a happiness which increases your whole well-being, because it determines the way you actually act or react, or how you actually live your life. Yeah. The happiness of calm is very short-lived, much like, almost, I mean, not like the sense happiness, it does last longer, but it you know, usually when you have a good meditation and you come out, or even if you have a good meditation retreat and you come out, very quickly that actually dissipates. That calm and peace can last a week, maybe, or a bit longer. Yeah. But it's the insights, the understandings into the process of what makes you tick, what makes you, you know, do things, and how everything works and fits into place. Those are the areas where the more lasting happiness comes. Yeah. And so we gather, little by little, our wisdom and our standing, our understanding as we go along the way. And so wisdom then supports our calm and peace, and our peace in turn supports our wisdom. So the two always go together. The more peace we have, the more clarity, the more we will see the way things really are. The more we see things the way they really are, the more the mind inclines to peace. Yeah? And so the two will always go together. Yeah? But they are supported by those other conditions. And so that's the thing I was hoping to bring out tonight. You know, by looking back, always tracing back the things where they came from. Yeah? And we can trace the wisdom back to the calm. We can trace the calm back to the mindfulness. We can trace the mindfulness back to the guarding of the senses. We can trace the guarding of the senses back to what? Why would we guard the senses? Faith? Or, again, wisdom? So there's a level of wisdom that starts the process off, and then later on there's a level of wisdom which is deeper. Sometimes people, they talk about the threefold training of the Buddha, virtue, meditation and wisdom. And they say, well, virtue comes first, then meditation, then wisdom. But you need a lot of wisdom to even keep your precepts, to be virtuous, because you got to have a reason, you got to have an incentive to set up a standard, to make priorities in your life, to set up the standards of virtue, so that you have that safety net, because you've realized that it's actually important. Yeah. And so all these factors, contemplating it, and then also taking it back to the actual theory, even though without deep samadhi we won't be able to see that process directly that I talked about a little bit, about how actually the eye and form make contact with mind consciousness, the mind attending to these things. Yeah. And then how that which is actually being contacted is not so much the eye, but our accumulated body of like and dislike. And so that's a little talk for you tonight on hopefully bringing up a little bit of incentive to, sometimes look a little bit deeper and have faith in the Buddhist teachings. Pick it up and run away with it. So there you are. Any comments or questions tonight? I had a big bag. I could have bought back a big bag like this, because there were 120 people on this retreat, and they were so keen in asking questions. Every evening I had to answer sometimes for an hour and a half, for 2 hours, questions. And so I collected them all and I put them in a plastic bag, and it was this big plastic bag of questions. And first I thought I'd bring them back just for the fun of it, but then I didn't bother. So it's quite good. So asking questions is good. So don't be afraid of asking questions. Yes?
What's happening? breaking the cycle of that reaction is more important than no experience. If you knock everything up, you're not going to learn anything. It's really the point of my mind.
Now, the guarding of the senses is I probably sometimes when you talk about these things you take certain things for granted, and maybe I didn't point out that I did mention, and probably that's why you're coming from that angle, is I did say that we shouldn't frequent certain areas, or we shouldn't go into certain things, or we shouldn't. That's one thing, one aspect of sense restraint or guarding of the senses, where you know if you go in there, that's going to be causing problems. But the actual practice of guarding of the senses is a moment-to-moment activity where you don't disregard the objects that come in. Yeah? But the standard way the Buddha would talk about how to actually do that is when the eye sees a form, you neither pick up or attach to the nimitta. Is like in that context is like the first impression, nor do you adhere or attach or pick up or proliferate on the subsequent associations that come up. In other words, if you just to give an example, you see a particular flash image just for a split second, right? So there's your first image. Yeah. So sometimes the sound, it can be just a short image, just a short, you know, stimulation or through any of the senses, right? And then even if you shut the eye at that moment, or if you are doing something else, yeah, the mind can sometimes create all these associations. One little smell can bring up a whole train of thought, memories, proliferations, plans, all this kind of stuff, yeah. Any little sight, even if it's just like a billboard, just for a flash seconds, that's how advertisement works. You just see it in moving past, yes? And then the mind creates everything else, yeah? So all the associations that come with very short, sometimes split second, momentary impressions through the senses, yeah? And so the Buddha said, you neither adhere to the first impression nor to the subsequent associations. So what he meant by that is, ideally, and it is a very lofty form of practice. So sense restraint, or the guarding of the senses, is not easy. What you're supposed to be doing is you just allow sight to be sight, sound to be sound, yeah, and you contemplate what it actually does. Yeah, but again, you need for that sense restraint, you need already quite a degree of mindfulness. Yeah? To be able to do it, and so it's actually reflecting on the process by seeing what it actually does. So you're always looking at cause and effect. Yeah? So you become aware of the fact that the mind is actually being conditioned by those impressions. Whatever impressions come through the senses has an effect on the mind. Yeah? And if we understand that, we can actually see how the mind is creating so much more, or in relation, the mind is creating more around a particular sense impression than the actual impression. Yeah? And remember, what is actually being contacted there is not just the eye, yeah? But it is actually, we're looking back at what is actually being contacted is the mind's desire and aversion. Yeah? So it's more like sense restraint is quite a refined practice already, but it's not just shutting off, because if you just block off sense contact, the Buddha said, then there was a funny sutta I remember now, where he asked, or somebody asked, what was it again? Some guy asked one of those other wanderers of ascetics at the time of the Buddha, said, well, how does your master, how does your teacher practice the guarding of the senses? And he says, the eye does not see forms, the ear does not hear sound, or something like that. In other words, he's saying you just don't see or hear anything. And then he says, and then a blind and a deaf man have very good sense restraint, don't they? And of course, that's not the point. You know, it's not the point of just cutting your ears out, or cutting your ears off, or poking your eyes out, because the desire is in here, is in the mind. You know, desire and aversion is not in the eyes, it's not in the ears. Yeah. So you shouldn't cut off. You should cut off what you should be cutting off, but not cut off what you shouldn't be cutting off. Yeah. Make sense? Yeah. Say as a monk, you're not supposed to cut off your penis because that doesn't do the trick. Now that doesn't free you from lust. But you should cut off your desire from lust, because that is what drives you around. If you understand desire, where it's coming from, yeah, then you got a chance. So you got to cut off the right thing. Any other questions? No, it's very important not to go through the world trying to just shut it off. You know, we have to contemplate it, look at it, and be honest. Yeah? Don't run away from things. Good enough? Another question? Yes, in the background, Eddie? I'm not really reading what you're trying to say, but... No. I haven't got enough wisdom. Right. Well, the cause, to reflect on the causes, I mean, it. Yeah, but it's very difficult. I mean, that's probably the point you're trying to make. I mean, sometimes to see the causes, yeah, we might see them in a theoretical level, yeah, but we don't actually see them on a deeper level yet. And that's why to really reflect with wisdom on cause and effect, you have to have an incredibly, you know, sharp mind, which is actually sharpened by mindfulness, and already, like, you know, mindfulness and meditation. That's why the wisdom can never really arise in a mind that just tries to think and get to the source of the problem by figuring it out through thinking. Yeah? So the real wisdom is actually a seeing without any thought going on whatsoever. You're actually looking at a process. You see a thought arising in the mind, or so you see something arising, yeah, and the mind actually sees the cause behind it. But it's not through thinking, it's not trying to figure it out in a theoretical manner. And that's why, you know, sometimes people seem to not get, I mean, you can never get to it through thinking. Yeah? Which doesn't, however, mean that thought has no place. I mean, you have to use your contemplation. Well, if you really see the cause, you let it go, because you don't want to suffer. Yeah, I mean, we want happiness. Yeah, we don't want to suffer. Yeah, so if you say that this is the cause of my suffering, and you're still suffering, you haven't seen it. Because the whole point of insight is, if somebody gives you a red hot glowing coal, it puts it into your hand, and you're not going to say, well, this is a red hot glowing coal, it is hot on the top, it is hot on the sides, it's glowing hot on the bottom, I better put this coal down. Yeah? That's not how insight works. I mean, the moment you see the cause of suffering, there is letting go. I mean, if you don't, then it's just a superficial seeing of the cause. Yeah? And so that's why the real wisdom is actually penetrating. I mean, that's where letting go happens. Because letting go, you can't let go. Nobody can do letting go. Yeah, letting go happens as a result of seeing the truth. You're seeing that it causes you suffering. If you haven't seen it yet, you're not going to let go. Yeah, well, that's... Yes, the small insights might not lead to... I mean, the small insights don't necessarily lead to a permanent cutting off. You're right there, you know. But that's why you have, it's a continuous process, it's a very gradual training. Yeah? And so that's why, I mean, you're not jumping in the deep end there. You're kind of, you know, you're looking at where am I, you know, what, where do I start? So it's each, is for each to figure out for themselves. That's why I said in the beginning, everybody here, you know, perceives their own little world. And so everybody has to figure out what they want to do. Anyway, I think it's getting, sorry, one question more? Sorry, yeah? Maybe enough. Sorry? The conditioning, it's based, I mean, it's like asking whether the chicken or the egg came first, you know, because the conditioning is the very process that is going on. Yeah? So there were causes that lead to results, and those results lead to other causes for results to come. So you have the causes from the past, yeah, that lead to results in the present moment, and our reaction to the present moment is creating causes for the future. Yeah? And so that's why in the meditation we focus on the present moment, because the present moment is the link between the causes and the results, in the sense that what we are experiencing now, when we look at it very clearly, we see that it is the coming to fruition of causes from the past. Yeah? And we can see how the present is already creating causes for the future. Yeah? And so if you really stay mindfully in the present moment, it's almost like you're abandoning the cause and effect process for that moment, because you're just looking and observing. Yeah? But usually we're actually caught up in creating causes by running back and forth between the past and the future. Yeah? But to ask where conditioning is coming from is a question that you'd have to say from conditioning, you know, because and then the question would be, well, where was the first cause? Yeah? And there the Buddha actually said there is no first cause. Just like you cannot say which came first, the chicken or the egg. Yeah. And you know, and that's always only makes sense in the context of many lifetimes, obviously. Yeah. So the causes that have been set in a long, long time ago. I don't know if that made any sense. So yes? True forgiveness is letting go, or true letting go is forgiveness. Because when you truly forgive, yeah, you allow, you accept the reality for what it is, yeah, and at the same time you abandon the holding on to it, as even as a, you know, you can't cut off your memories, but by letting go or forgiving, you're not actually creating any more causes for torturing yourself, as it were, into the future. So really, if you forgive someone or something, or forgive yourself, oftentimes it's the hardest one to forgive ourselves for something that we've done. Then if we really forgive ourselves, then we allow those things to let go. Because forgiveness comes as a result of seeing that we've been torturing ourselves, or we're torturing other people by holding on to something which doesn't really, we can't change. Yeah? Forgiveness is usually about something from the past, yeah, which we've done, which was not correct, or which we haven't done, which we should have done. And so the forgiveness comes from a recognition of the fact that we are not perfect, we make mistakes, yeah, and we recognize that, we accept it, we don't suppress it, yes, but we recognize that we have made a mistake, but we also see the fact that we can't change that, but we have to go on. Yeah? And we know that it's the wisdom that tells us if we don't forgive, we can't go on. If we don't let go certain things and keep carrying them as burdens around for the rest of our lives, it's just going to torture us and other people. Does that make sense? Okay, now people are getting going. More questions? We have for another couple hours. Collect another plastic bag full. Nothing? Okay, knock off then. Was there one more? Sorry, say some more? Yeah? good on you. I quoted a blog from he's on the retreat. No, he's not here tonight. But he said once to me, he said, I work 3 days a week because if I worked 4 days a week, I'd be working more than I have time off, and that's no good. And he gets away with it.